This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
I'm Andrew Johnstone, and you're listening to The Last Breath, the podcast about death and dying. Brought to you by Hospice Waikato in association with Free FM, the Waikato's community access media organisation. In this episode, I'm talking with Susan O'Regan about her mother Catherine. Waipa MP from 1984 to 1996, as Associate Health Minister, Catherine was instrumental in developing New Zealand's world-leading breast screening program, an illness that would later claim her own life.
Well, I'm Susan O'Regan. I'm in my day job, Mayor of Waipa at the moment, for maybe two more days. My background is in family law. I'm also a dairy farmer, mum of five kids. I brought up at Rukahia, out on the swamp on the outskirts of Hamilton. Waipa girl, kind of born and bred. My family has been in this rohe for well over a century now, sort of farmers and sawmillers and politicians kind of speckle my family tree for as long as it stretches back. But very deep connection to this area. And I suppose some of the political kind of stuff is just synonymous with who my family is. And how I grew up, and that is because not only my mother, but her parents before her and before them, they always were very active thinkers in terms of civic affairs and the like. So there were always discussions at the table around tax rates and all sorts of current affairs. I guess that was just part and parcel of who we were. And of course, as I grew up, I'm 53 now, so born in 1972. In my lifetime, the discussions we had around the table certainly didn't ease up. They escalated, if you like, in that area. And, we had, thinking back now, things like the Springbok Tour and nuclear-free New Zealand, all these sorts of issues were just commonly discussed around our table. And being the daughter at the time of a then politician, and my dad was a farmer and sawmiller, they were really pertinent things about our lives and impacted on us quite markedly. So my mother was or is, I'm never really sure how you say that, is Catherine O'Regan, and my dad was Neil O'Regan, and they're both passed away now. Both died of cancer. My dad died, must be coming up 21 years now. He died of melanoma, which was a bit, it was a slow kind of a progression of a disease for him, but spending most of his life outdoors and a man with very little hair, it was no real surprise, I guess, that melanoma got him at some point. And my mother, Catherine, passed away 7.5 odd years ago now. I was raised on a dairy, it was a dairy farm, converted to a dairy farm at Rukahia. I have one brother, Andrew, who's now a builder for Livingstone's actually in Te Omoto. He's married with two girls. Great family life. My dad managed the family sawmill, O'Regan Sawmill. Anybody lived out near Rukahia will recall good old O'Regan Sawmill and our family farm, which ran in conjunction with my grandparents' farm next door. Mum was always a very vivacious, warm, opinionated person. And when there was some, as I recall, some disagreement around the traps about representation around the then Waipa County Council, there was some decisions being made that the general group in Rukahia were not happy about. So they sort of said to Mum, you'd be great on council, you should run. And she thought, bugger it, I will. So she did. So she stood for council, and got on. And that was at a time where she was also the electorate agent then for Marilyn Waring. And I probably should have gone back a little bit, but when Marilyn was seeking the nomination for the National Party for the then Raglan seat, I think it was called, way back then, in 1975, I think it would have been, the arrangement is that they go around to voting. If you're a candidate, you have to seek support from voting delegates, and Mum was a voting delegate, being a paid-up member of the National Party at the time, as her parents before her had been, and probably before them. And there was a knock at the door, the story goes, and Mum answered the door. She was up to her elbows in flour because she was getting food ready for... Obviously, we had something going on. I don't know whether it was what they were doing on the farm, but Mum was responsible for creating all this food for all the men on the farm. So she said to Marilyn, oh, look, can you just wait a minute? I've got to get this food out. So Mum got this food out, and apparently I was about 2 at the time, and I'd woken up from a sleep in my cot and was being a bit of a pain, as I recall, as the story goes. And so Marilyn went and picked me up out of my cot and took me outside. And Mum was a prolific gardener. She had a huge, big veggie patch, as most women of that era did in the rural sector. And apparently Marilyn and I went around squeezing and killing all of the white moth caterpillars on Mum's cabbages. And then when she finally got the food out to the men on the farm, they sat down and had their chat. And the story goes that Marilyn said to Mum, "Oh, I've never been a candidate before, so I don't know what questions to ask you." And Mum looked at her and said, "Well, I've never been a voting delegate either, so I can't help you there." And from that point, they just got on like a house on fire, and Mum was really struck with Marilyn's intellect, and she's just a sharp individual, and she still is, and was really captivated by this young 21-year-old who was really ironically standing to show that it was impossible for women to enter into Parliament, and of course she proved herself wrong. So, so began a lifelong friendship, and Mum became her electorate agent. So she then became more deeply involved in political affairs through supporting Marilyn through those years. And then when Marilyn made the announcement that she was going to retire, Mum had been having this parallel life of not only being a wife and mother and farmer, but also a county councillor, and having this insight into what was going on in Wellington and how Wellington worked. And she decided, she was up for it, and she sought nomination and was successful. And so she replaced Marilyn. There'd been some boundary changes at the time, and she then became, the electorate became Waipa eventually, which at that time also took in Otorohanga. So largely the electorate that is now Waipa district, but included Otorohanga, as I recall. So, and she represented that area for 15 or so years, and became at one point a minister outside cabinet. She was minister for women's affairs, associate women's affairs, associate health, and minister of consumer affairs, as it was then. But always outside cabinet. She was always pleased to be outside cabinet. Didn't really want to have the added burden of being in cabinet. So, but I think upon retirement, she reflected on her years in Parliament and her greatest, the thing she took the greatest satisfaction. Two things, I suppose. One was her constituency work, where she'd hold what she called surgery days in both Te Awamutu and Cambridge, and would meet with people who were having problems with interfaces with government departments, and Mum would then intervene or help guide them through the process or what have you. So she liked that one-on-one helping people with problems sort of stuff, which is kind of funny because I went on to become a lawyer and I did similar stuff, so it's kind of a little bit of a parallel there. But and then the other thing she took great pride and or satisfaction in was her being able to steward through changes to the human rights legislation, which made illegal prejudicing against people for their sexual orientation, and for carrying organisms in the body that were communicable diseases, which at the time was sort of synonymous with AIDS and hepatitis. So mum was quite ahead of her times, I guess, in that space, and was much lauded and respected in particularly the sort of the homosexual community at the time. She was also really passionate about education. She was motivated in part to get to stand for Parliament because my brother, Andrew, is dyslexic, very badly dyslexic, and he also has a very bad stutter. And she'd been involved quite heavily with SPELD, Specific Learning Disabilities organisation, and actually became the president for the Waikato prior to going into Parliament. And she wanted to work with the then Ministry of Education and to help them understand that not all kids learnt the same way, that there was, and to make them acknowledge that there were specific learning differences. And of course, now, you know, we have this whole understanding about neurodiversity and, you know, quite a significant step in terms of understanding that, you know, there are a variety, a spectrum of ways people learn. And so mum was sort of one of the, bit of a trailblazer in some of that work as well. So, and then another piece of work that she was always really proud of, I think, was dealing with the Prostitutes Collective and looking at trying to bring in health measures that protected them and the decriminalisation of sex work in New Zealand. So something she was really knees deep involved in. So very progressive, you know, always really progressive in her social issues and social policy, but at the same time quite conservative in terms of the way she saw the world in an economic sort of sense, and I'm probably not too dissimilar from her in that respect. But yeah, look, very much ahead of her time. Then in the, I can't remember when it was now, but MMP kind of trotted along, and that changed a lot of mum's prospects, I guess, for ongoing election. Waipa as a electorate got carved up between Taupō and Taranaki King Country, and at the time Taranaki King Country meant that, or the other elected member or MP who was represented from that area was Jim Bolger, so mum was probably not going to beat him out for the nod. So she agreed to take the challenge up and stand in Tauranga, so long as she got in exchange a pretty good place on the then party list. So that sort of spelt the end for her of representing this area, which I know grieved her because she's a Waipa girl through and through. This is where she was brought up at Raglan, or Te Mata, so that she's always been a rural woman at heart. So it did grieve her a little bit, I think, to not be able to have a place that she felt was her sort of tūranga waiwai, that she spoke for these sorts of people. But anyway, nevertheless, threw her energies hugely into trying to turn Tauranga. And it was the election where, when she came within, I think it was 23 or 21 votes of ousting Winston Peters from Tauranga, which of course would have probably, or possibly, meant that there was history could have taken quite a different path. Although he's a bit of a phoenix, isn't he? You know, he goes and then he comes back and goes and comes back. So anyway, it was that was an interesting period of interesting chapter. But eventually, decided that retirement at home back to Te Awamutu was more her style, and she went back to the grassroots, which, from where it all sort of began, and threw herself into the establishment of a health shuttle, for example, in Te Awamutu. It's a very successful operation now that shuttles people to and from Te Awamutu to the hospital for specialist appointments if they don't have the ability to get themselves there on their own accord, and people just pay a koha, and it's a neat organisation. And just got involved in a lot more grassroots type things. She got involved in family planning, was on their board for a while, and a handful of other things. So, but
just on that point, she was very big on getting sex education into schools and educating kids at a young age, and she wanted condom vending machines in high schools and in public toilets.
Correct, yeah.
And I just got to say at this juncture that I'm struggling to understand how a rural woman who stood for National was so socially progressive and so open-minded. But then again, so was Jim Bolger.
Yeah.
So it was an extraordinary time.
Yeah, I sometimes think the characterisation of sort of conservative politicians is not really accurate, and certainly in the New Zealand context. And I think too, like I look at somebody like Mum. She trained initially to be a nurse, and that was her passion. She, as a little girl, she wanted to be was to be like Florence Nightingale. So it's romanticised ideas about being a nurse, and so she always had a real affinity for the human condition, if you like, and wanting to improve people's lot. And she was not, there was no judgment there. So, you know, if you see a problem of teen pregnancy, let's fix that. Let's not judge. Let's fix, sort of, is the way that she would see those things. And as a result, she got nicknamed Condom Kate for that. And I recall she used to have a... somebody, it must have been through family planning, would have, you know how corporate gifts are created. They must have had a whole batch of key rings printed or made up, and they had, you know, in the little flagon of it, a condom set in a bit of plastic, you know. And that was Mum's key ring for many years, this condom thing. But, there was no judgment there. She didn't judge. She had her own... she had a very strong own personal Christian beliefs, but there was no judgment attached to any of it, and only ever wanting to find solutions for very human conditions and human problems. Very, very empathetic person, very empathetic, and generally well liked. I remember when after she died, I had the great privilege of being able to do pull together a speech and deliver it at her funeral. And doing the research for it, I came across Bill Ralston, who, of course, was well-known at the time, had made the comment that Catherine O'Regan was genuinely the only nice person in Parliament. And I thought that was high praise indeed, for coming from Bill Ralston. So, she was as comfortable in Parliament as she would be in a marae, as she would be... at the UN. I mean, that was another highlight, going and speaking to New Zealand's report to the to CEDAW, the Elimination of Discrimination, the Convention of Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. So that was a highlight for her career, to go and present to the UN on our behalf. She's comfortable there, as she would be, as I say, on a marae, as she would be at a 21st, as she would be at the supermarket, and just very... an easy and well likable person, and very personable. So, yeah. Oh gosh, so where were we? So, yeah, retirement, and she made the decision that she wanted to focus on family a bit more. I mean, it takes a huge toll on your family being in public life. And I was 12 when she went to Parliament, and obviously 15 years later, wasn't. And I had a son at the time, and she volunteered to look after him while I went back to work as a lawyer in town here, so in Te Omoto. So her sights focused home and family and community. And I guess it's one of the deepest ironies, because of her involvement in when she was the Associate Minister for Health, that she became like a dog with a bone at trying to implement the breast screening programs in New Zealand, having looked at the data around rates of survival if with early intervention, and screening programs were always the way to be able to get this stuff early. And so she had a very large role to play in the implementation of those breast screening programs and the boob buses. She used to refer to them as the boob bus. And the boob bus was in town in Te Omoto, parked outside the visitor centre there. So like everybody, I mean, no airs and graces, not expecting to go anywhere else. She'd be like everybody else, she'd do what everybody else does. trotted down to the Bow bus and had her screening done. And unfortunately, they picked up a mass. So began her journey through breast cancer. She had a lumpectomy, and they removed some lymph nodes, and they discovered obviously it wasn't in the lymph nodes, which is positive thing. And they were confident that they'd got the, all they needed to. They had a good margin around the breast. She had a series of radiography too at the time. And yeah, she was good for, I'm thinking now, probably about 6 years, five years. But then she started getting these funny, they were hard to describe. She had aches in her back, down on here and on her ribs. Anyway, long story not particularly shortish, as it turned out that it had metastasized to her bones, so she'd now had bone cancer. And of course, bone cancer is something that you can, it's a condition you can live with. You just keep on top of the pain, you're not going to necessarily die from it, so long as it stays in check. So she went through a series of treatment around bone strengthening and chemo. And she responded really well to a lot of that and was really a very positive patient, as you could probably imagine. Ian Campbell was her oncologist at Waikato Hospital, and he was just fabulous. And then got to a point where she started having these episodes where she'd just get really kind of worked up, and she just knew something wasn't right. And they discovered that she had shadows on what's called the dura mater, I think it's called, which is the membrane between the brain and the skull. And it had, again, jumped from the bones to there. And ironically, I understand that dura mater is Latin for tough mother. I might be wrong on that, no doubt. Somebody's going to research that and prove me wrong, but at the time I thought that's what it was. And at that point it became clear they probably wouldn't be able to help her any longer because it was sort of from here up. So she'd done everything she could for those earlier years and had some really good quality of life living with cancer and keeping it as bay as best she could. But once it had jumped to her, the dura mater, it was not likely to be able to be fixable. And at the time they'd sort of said the prognosis was that growths would continue and she would experience more stroke-like kind of symptoms, which was a terrifying way to consider her going out, if you like. But thankfully, that wasn't the case in the end. It had ended up spreading to more organs eventually, and she managed to retain her faculties right to the very end, for which we're enormously grateful. For somebody who had such a great mind, it sort of seems wildly cruel to have that go. But no, she was fortunate in that respect. So yeah, she was a really I remember actually I was cleaning up some of her boxes the other day. There was an article. Even when with her diagnosis, she was determined to make sure that it be publicised to encourage people to go and be screened and all that sort of stuff. So she was never even used her illness to try and shed the light on issues that needed attention. So, and I think she even used her health shuttle too. it was kind of ironic, the things that she'd put in place she was now benefiting from. But I remember taking her up to have her visit with Ian Campbell, her oncologist, and she bought him a little jar of crab apple jelly. My stepfather used to play golf at Te Omutu, and along the fairways there are some crab apple trees, and he used to pick them up, being an Englishman, and shove them in his pockets and bring them home and say, do you think you can make some crab apple jelly, Catherine? So Mum used to make this wonderful crab apple jelly. Anyway, we went to see Ian at Waikato and pulls out of her handbag this jar of crab apple jelly. And she said, I do apologise, Ian, it's not quite set. I don't know what quite went wrong with that one. And he's laughing away because he said, Catherine, what I see in this file is not what I see in you. You, her her presentation didn't reflect how gravely unwell she was. And he did say that at the time that she was diagnosed, he had two other clients diagnosed about the same time, and two of them chose the positive, I'm going to get on with living and make, you know, do what I can do to try and keep this at bay. And one of them turned their face to the wall, and they had passed away very quickly. And so he was a great believer in the value of being really positive. And obviously it's not going to, you can't out positive cancer till, you know, forever, but it certainly brought her a lot of usable life and time that being morose and giving up, I think, you'd be denied. So, but yeah, he was always just quite dumbstruck with her presentation. He said, "Catherine, don't apologise about your crab apple jelly not setting, because you shouldn't be, you know, this doesn't look like that." But yeah, and I used to take her up to the chemotherapy wards for chemotherapy, and I remember my son at the time, I couldn't find care for him, and he was a wee toddler, and I said, "Oh, just bring him with us, it'll be fine." And it's an experience I think everybody needs to undertake at some time, going into one of those wards. Oh my goodness, it's a place of hope, and it's a place of fear, a place of sadness and joy. They're unreal. The staff in those places, man, the stuff that they go through and see. But, yeah, it was lovely actually taking Ben at the time. It was Jack. Gosh, I'm terrible. Yeah, he skipped around, toddled around the place and brought a lot of joy to people who, you know, got hours sitting there and really compromised circumstances, seeing this little sunny blonde thing, blue eyes, totter along and pat them on the knee and then, you know, toddle along. It was pretty cute. So it was lovely. Mum thought it was great that he could come along from time to time. So, but yeah, that's an experience most people who, if you think you're having a bad day, go and hang out in one of those wards, you know. Perspective is a very, very powerful thing. And yeah, the nurses, by crikey, they're an amazing bunch. And it kind of, I think your perspective or your assumption would be that those wards are full of people like Mum, but they're not. They're full of people who are 23 and my age and in their 40s, you know, yeah, younger people. I think the youngest that we saw there was a young 12-year-old, I think. Maybe a bit older. But yeah, just real eye-opener. So I guess through it all, although we all know cancer's a bitch, because it totally is, it gave us the gift of being able to have everything set. Yeah. My heart breaks for people who lose their loved ones suddenly and they don't have the opportunity to say stuff. Because there's peace in being able to say that. And so that's a gift, I guess, we had. But, yeah, I'm not a naturally kind of a nursey. Mum got all those nursey genes. I'm a bit more down the line and hard-nosed. But I got the opportunity to sort of nurse her along with some of her darling nursing mates who, when she was first diagnosed, they pledged that they would nurse her at home if that was her wish, and they did. So she had these glorious three strong nursing mates from, you know, her early days, and myself sort of taking tag team at home looking after her. And she did. She passed away at home. But being able to have that opportunity, it was a real privilege to be with her. It's a very strange zone to move into. She was very mobile up till about the last sort of week became more challenged. And very lucid right up until probably the last day or two. I think we were still talking about international affairs. I can't even remember. Was it something that had happened in Asia? There was someone, I can't remember. And she was telling me all about it. And I remember sitting there thinking, gosh, you're unreal. You know more than I do. Because you sit there and listen to national radio and get angry with Catherine Ryan when Catherine wouldn't let the interviewers, the people she was interviewing answer questions. And right to the very end, she very opinionated. But, what a great honour to have been able to have that as somebody who's not a nursey person. But it is a very strange place to be. You get really, it is all-encompassing. It takes over everything about your life, nursing or being around somebody day in and day out who's dying. And you get angry with people who aren't in that because it's not a fun place to be. And at one point, I guess it must have been in the early part of, because that sort of the last fortnight I was pretty much there every day, and I did stay overnight from time to time if I felt things were getting a little more advanced or more challenging. But I'd pop out to the supermarket and I'd look at people in the meat aisle and you'd hear them saying, oh, that looks awful, or how expensive that is. And I just wanted to grab them by the scruff of the neck and say, for God's sake, at least you're not dying, the person that you love's not dying. Yeah, it's a funny space. You get angry with other people. I found that about me anyway. I got angry with other people who weren't in that death zone or death life, that hard place to be. And their complaints seem so petty. But it is a challenge. And I know that when my mum's mother had a series of strokes that hospitalised her, and she was in her night, she was 91, I think, when she passed away, finally. But mum sat with her at the hospital and said, no, mum, life is that I've got to go home. I've got to go to my family. I've got to focus on my family. My life is for the living, kind of conversation. And I remember having mum telling me about that and about how you have to reach a point where you've got to work out where your energies need to be. And it's not that she neglected Nan at all, but it was part of that conversation, I guess, enabling her to go. And I, in turn, had that same conversation with mum one way at this point. She'd said to me the 2 days before she died, and I was sitting on her bed with her doctor, actually, who'd just popped around, and she said, how do you... Because I said, mum, you can go, you can... You're obviously wanting to. And she said, yeah, just how do you, Susan? How do you go? And I really didn't have an answer for that. But she'd clearly wanted to by this point. And hospice were coming in and ensuring she was comfortable, and the nurse, her nursing friends were there, and I'd been there fairly solidly. And I just needed some space. I just needed to get out. This is on the last day. This is so... Because you don't know how... It's not like there's a pre-programmed time of death that you know about, right? You don't know how much longer you've got. And I'd never been with somebody who was dying. I didn't know. I guess in part I almost thought she might go on a bit longer. But I just needed to get out, and I was sitting with her, and I had my hand on hers, and I said, "Mum, I've just got to get out for an hour or two. I've got a function I need to go to." It was actually with the bank, of all places. But I just needed to get out and escape this. And she started saying, "No, don't go, don't go, don't go." And I was like, "Oh gosh, this is awful," because I was beginning to sort of lose it a bit too. So I sort of said, "Oh no, okay, Mum, I won't." Anyway, she fell back asleep, and then Marge, one of her nursing mates, gorgeous Marge, came in and said to me, "You need to go." And so I slipped my hand out from underneath Mum's, and Marge slipped hers in, and she sat. And I went for an hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever, came back. And I don't know if Mum ever knew that we did the switcheroo. I'll never know. But later that night, I said to her, "Mum, I need to go home. I need to focus on the living. I've got a family at home. And she didn't say anything. She didn't tell me to not go. So I went. And I came home, and it was a really moonlit night, like coming along Chamberlain Road. The moon just looked amazing. It's early May. A beautiful, clear, clear night. And I got home, and I was probably home all of about 20 minutes. And then the phone rang, and it was Vonnie, one of Mum's nursing mates, who said she'd just passed away. So I felt that I'd let her go, and then she let me go, and then it was doable. And it was interesting because it was nice that my brother was there. He had been busy and hadn't been able to be there, so he was there with her, which was nice. But I do feel like she let me go. And yeah. And and interestingly, the nurses said to me, they said it was a beautiful death. Again, I've not seen anybody die, but I have it on good authority from them. She didn't. It was reasonably quick. And she certainly didn't appear to be in a lot of distress or pain. So I went back in again, went back into Te Motu. The funeral director had been called, and they'd put her body into the back of a hearse, I suppose, or whatever it was, and they were holding it and wanted me to go and say goodbye. And I said, why would I want? I've already done that. She's not there. That's just the place that housed her. I've already said my goodbyes, and so I didn't want to see it. And they all thought it was crazy, but I just didn't want to. And I was like that with my dad when he died. I didn't want to see him either after he died. I just don't see the... for me, it's not something that I took any value from. And I know that I did see my grandmother when she died at the funeral home. And I remember just being really shocked because it didn't look like her. And it really struck me how much your spirit and who you are as a person really impacts how you look. You know, the way you hold your face and looking at Nana, I just really wasn't her. Just didn't look like her, and I didn't want to have that kind of lasting kind of picture of either of my parents, because they'd gone. They'd just left the vessel that had housed them, and it was no value for me in seeing that. But God, I miss her. God, the things she'd have to say about stuff now, craziness, like, you know, how I mean, I would love to have had her view around COVID, but, you know, having that sort of nursing kind of background and her views around all of that, and I can only guess, she would have had huge respect for Jacinda Ardern, but had to have been very clear that she'd park up her political politics for that. But she would despair of what we've cut, you know, of some of the sectors of our community becoming so polarised and divisive, and, you know, lacking evidential base for their claims and mis and disinformation and all that. She'd think it's disgraceful. But yeah, I miss her every day. More so during election campaigns. And I think having lost both parents, it's interesting because I'm 53 and a lot of my friends are in a position now where either they may have lost one parent or they are losing one parent or they're putting that their parents into care, or they're, you know, trying to get them out of the family home into a retirement place where they can be cared for more, or looked after more, more diligently. And I know that's hard. It must be hard. It has to be hard. But it's something that I was deprived of that, because both my parents went quite young, and I always feel a bit aggrieved. The loss didn't just mean a loss to me. It's a loss to my kids. They didn't really get to know their grandparents. I mean, of my children, only Ben got to meet my dad, and Jack, who's my youngest, he was two at her funeral, three at her funeral. So, yeah, I grew up with my grandparents next door, and they were a huge part of my life. And I'm really sad that my children don't have that, because Mum was a fantastic grandmother and person. So that I feel a bit robbed for them. And I feel robbed for Mum that she didn't get a chance to see, like, Lily, for example, our daughter, her oldest granddaughter, is just going ahead gangbusters at boarding school, and just such a great person. And Mum would just take such pride in her. So, yeah, she missed out on a lot too. But yeah, people who my age are putting their parents into homes and dealing with dementia and stuff, I can understand that must take a huge toll. But yeah, losing your parents quite early is hard too. And I think you don't realise how much, I was fortunate, had really good relationships with both my parents, much stronger with my mum than my dad, but still really good relationships. When they're gone, you lose your rudder. The person that you can go to and say, am I being stupid? You know, give me a talking to. Tell me I'm wrong here. Or so you're very much on your own. You don't have that person, those people to go to who can really tell you to pull your head out. You know, stop being so stupid, or... You know, and that's, I've found that's been really lonely, really lonely. And until you lose your parents, I don't think you can ever understand it. So to the people who are, you know, bemoaning putting their parents into care and things, there's a worse option, and that's not having them at all. And I guess I've been like that now for, as I say, Dad's been gone 21 years and Mum 7. So yeah, it's the lack of, and the other shift in terms of Mum passing, she was sort of I described her as the sun of our universe for our family, and that's our broader family too. She was the only daughter of farmers from Te Mata, and a handful of brothers, and very big family. And she's had to pass sort of the baton on, and I've kind of become the person that organises the family functions, but now thankfully some of my other cousins are also offering to do that sort of stuff. So, but in the absence of the glue, the centre point, the sun of our solar system, things can become a bit fractured and families kind of break away and do their own thing. So we've been really diligent about every 2 years holding, my mum's last maiden name was Newton, and she and her four brothers, she had four brothers, and she was the number four out of five in the family. And always a very fun social family. They're always so much fun. But every 2 years now we organise a new, it's called the Newton Classic. We vie for a golf trophy. It's an Ambrose golf tournament we have. And all gather and descend en masse, either here at the farm or up in Waitangi, where one of my other cousins lives up there. And we all get together, usually about 95 of us, or give or take, depending on who can and can't make it. Always a great time. But you have to make those deliberate decisions to do that sort of stuff. But before Mum, Nettie, her mother, was the source of all of the information, you know, the postcards from trips away and so-and-so's had a baby, so here are the photos that get sent, and they always sit on the coffee table. And then mum became that person, the sort of repository for all of the family information. And unfortunately, we're not, because we don't do snail mail so much now, but we use other means. We have a family Facebook page and now a WhatsApp group. So that's how we communicate, but there's no one sole leader of it. But yeah, there was that time originally after she passed away that was like, oh, so what now? Who's the son now? And thankfully it's no one son, we're all kind of taking in. But I've been privileged to kind of carry a lot of the family history, and hence some of the family taonga are on my walls, and bags and bags and boxes of family histories. And mum was a great genealogist, so I've kind of got all of this stuff, so it sort of all vests with me now. And she did say to me, she was partway through doing, I think she wrote 7 books about different branches of our family, another thing she really got into in her latter years. And she got partway through doing another book, and as it remains unfinished, and she sort of said to me that it's up to me to do it, but I haven't had the time. But yeah, so it's not just you, it's not just them, it's not just your kids, but it's the broader impact too. But yeah, I miss her every day. Every day.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.